At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. My colleague and friend, Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, Gatestone, Newsweek, and The Hill, here with me to explore a mystery, and we need help. This has to do with the U.S. Navy and India. That's right, India, the Republic of India, the world's largest democracy, part of an alliance that are newly formed called the Quad, India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. Formed in order to deal with the aggression by the PRC, the PLA Navy and Air Force, the Chinese Communists. However, Cleo Pascal joins us now, non-resident senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, to explain a strange news item that flummoxes me. Cleo, a very good evening to you. I read from the report. The unauthorized passage of a U.S. naval ship through India's exclusive economic zone has created a highly avoidable controversy, which may appear to be a case of the conflict arising out of the interpretation and application of international and national laws. That's a rationalization by the author of this op-ed. The U.S. 7th Fleet Commander announced that, quote, on 7 April 2021, the USS John Paul Jones asserted navigational rights and freedoms approximately 130 nautical miles west of islands belonging to India, inside India's exclusive economic zone, without requesting India's prior consent. It said its act was, quote, consistent with international law. Cleo, is this a quandary for Delhi? Is everybody puzzled about this on that side of the world? Good evening to you.
Good evening. This is very unfortunate, to say the least. It's left a lot of people perplexed, and it's given an opening to China lobbies and Russia lobbies in Delhi to say, look, we told you you couldn't trust the U.S. Here they are saying they're your best friends, and suddenly they're declaring you have excessive maritime claims and running freedom of operation navigation through your waters. So it's a kind of inexplicable own goal on the part of the U.S. The only thing that kind of has been used to explain it is to say they're trying to show the U.S. is trying to show China that they're not the only one that experience U.S. freedom of navigation operations, so they shouldn't take it personally. But if that's the logic, that's kind of insane given the current geopolitical tensions that you're seeing now and how much the U.S. and India have started to work together well. I mean, I don't understand this kind of self-sabotage.
Gordon, it is a puzzle. Do you have a question for Cleo?
Cleo, I rarely disagree with you, almost never. But the point here, though, is that India does exert that it has the right to approve the passage of vessels through its exclusive economic zone. And that would seem to be excessive under, for instance, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, to which the United States is not a party, but we do adhere to it. It does seem to me, though, that India is trying to assert really more than it's entitled to in terms of its control over its exclusive economic zone. What is the explanation for this?
I think we do agree. They're kind of two separate issues. One is this legal question between the U.S. and India. And from what I've heard, that actually the U.S. has run these sorts of operations through those waters before. The difference now is putting out a press release from the 7th Fleet, making it public. So it's one thing to kind of exert the rights and say, look, we disagree on this and we're going to show you we disagree on this. And the other is we're going to call you out in front of the whole world. And by the way, by the U.S. doing this, this gives the right now to Chinese ships to do it, to say, look, you know, the U.S. says that they're allowed to run their military ships within your exclusive economic zone, so we will too. So there are different ways of doing the same thing. And yeah, you're completely right. There is a disagreement around international law or national law on this. But by doing it in this way, the Seventh Fleet have given an opening to anti-U.S. forces within India to try to undermine what is a growing partnership, and at the same time given an opening to China to run through strategic waters based on a U.S. precedent.
Cleo, the additional mystery to me is the U.S. certainly acknowledges that China's aggression is uncalled for and irregular and unacceptable. I'm thinking of the Himalayas, but I'm also thinking of threats, routine threats for Chinese commerce. That's been going on. You've been reporting it for months and months and months. So the U.S. is not conducting this as if it's an honest broker between China and India over some commercial dispute. China is a bad actor. The U.S. acknowledges that in other spheres. Why would I'm stuck, Cleo. I'm stuck how the U.S. could argue this is a gain for the Quad or for the U.S.
It's very difficult to say because the most generous definition would be that, this is diplomats trying to exert the law uniformly. The less charitable interpretation, which you're hearing in the Indian press, is that, look, they got played by China lobby within the U.S. system. And aren't they dumb? They think that they're doing one thing, but actually they're being used to do something else. And I can tell you this has gained a lot of momentum within India very, very quickly because there are China lobbies within all of the systems waiting for these openings. So suddenly, you start to see articles talking about how the U.S. Seventh Fleet, the last time that it came up in the Indian press was in 1971 when India was trying to help Bangladesh gain independence from Pakistan, and the U.S. sent the Seventh Fleet to basically threaten India in the Bay of Bengal, and the wonderful Soviets came and shadowed the Seventh Fleet on behalf of India. So it plays into kind of all of these other narratives that are sitting there waiting to create problems in the India-U.S. relationship. And they happen fast. Which makes me think that, they're waiting for this sort of own goal in order to try to create this friction. And remember, we're in a very sensitive negotiation phase around the S-400 purchase, the Russian missile defense purchase. So anything that creates a wedge between the U.S. and India at this point is a very big win for Beijing and for Moscow.
Gordon, the puzzle for me, in addition, is this would be an outlier if it wasn't for the fact that in the Middle East, the Biden administration is making entreaties to the intransigent Palestinians, that in Iran, they're openly not enforcing the sanctions. They're openly allowing Iran or allowing Iran to conduct provocative moments. In Ukraine, they're provocative moments. The Biden administration is acting oddly, Gordon. Maybe this is just part of the new way in Washington. They do something and we try to figure it out.
I actually think that this is probably just the U.S. Navy exercising its traditional role. The other things you point out are inexplicable, John. The Biden administration is pursuing, I think, as you point out, foreign policies that actually undermine U.S. interests and the interests of our allies. And there are a number of others. And especially at a critical time when the Russians are massing on the Ukraine border, this is a particularly sensitive moment because we could be in global conflict in days, considering what can happen in Crimea.
Cleo, we just have a minute here. Is Delhi looking for an explanation? Yes. Have they asked for the ambassador or their contacts in Washington to in some way present this story as a positive?
No, well, because it was an official Seventh Fleet issued press release, they had to issue their own official sort of "we don't agree with you" press release. And I would just go back to this, this issue. I really, Gordon, I really hope you're right, and you may very well be right. This much better than I do in terms of how it works in the U.S. You know, but, you know, if you remember 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Russia was keeping the U.S. busy somewhere else, that was when China invaded India in the Himalayas the last time.
Right.
So, you know, we really need to keep an eye on what's happening across the board. And not just in isolation.
Cleo Pascal, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, Gatestone, Newsweek, and The Hill. I'm John Batchelor. Neanderthals. Could our extinct cousins, the Neanderthals, the last vanished about 40,000 years ago, produce and hear sounds and frequencies we Homo sapiens use for speech? A new study from a Spanish team reported in Nature created 3D reconstructions of the middle and outer ears of five Neanderthal remains. Our cousins may have had the same capability as us to hear high frequencies of consonant sounds, such as T, K, and F. Non-human bipeds, such as chimpanzees, can best hear vowel sounds only. Did our cousins have a language? Cave art indicates the Neanderthals could think in symbols, a fundamental, nature reminds us, of language. The John Batchelor Show, all hours available all the time on distinguished podcasters such as Apple Podcasts.